This is EOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. AP correspondent Norman Hall reports U.S. and other frustrated mediators are calling on Israel and Hamas to resume Gaza talks.
Leaders of the United States, Egypt, and Qatar have jointly demanded Israel and Hamas return to stalled talks on the war in Gaza next week. The leaders say that only the details of carrying out a ceasefire and hostage release remain to be negotiated. In a joint statement, they say that there is no further time to waste nor excuses from any party for further delay. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office says it has accepted the invitation. Since Hamas militants killed 1,200 people in Israel on October 7th, Israel's offensive in Gaza has killed nearly 40,000 people. I'm Norman Hall.
Russian and Ukrainian forces clashed in Russia's Kursk region for a third consecutive day on Thursday, according to Russia's defense ministry. But while Ukrainian officials are saying little, the incursion appears to have the blessing of the United States. VOA's Jeff Selden explains.
Pentagon spokesperson Sabrina Singh telling reporters the U.S. still does not support any long-range Ukrainian attacks into Russia. But she says this is different.
They are taking actions to protect themselves from attacks that are coming from a region that are within the U.S. policy of where they can operate, our weapons, our systems, our capabilities.
Singh also says the U.S. sees the Ukrainian actions advancing by some estimates as far as 10 kilometers into Russia as defensive. Jeff Selden, VOA News, Washington.
Authorities say two suspected attacks by Yemen's Houthi rebels targeted a ship in the strategic Bel El Mandeb Strait that links the Gulf of Aden to the Red Sea. The Houthis did not immediately claim the assaults on Thursday and Friday, though they follow a months-long campaign by the rebels. This is VOA News. Nobel Peace Prize laureate Muhammad Yunus has taken the oath of office to lead Bangladesh's interim government after protests forced out the Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina this week. The key task for Yunus now is restoring peace in the South Asian country and preparing for new elections following the ouster of Hasina, who fled to India after student protest over job quotas grew into an uprising against her increasingly autocratic 15-year rule. The figurehead president administered the oath to Yunus for his role as chief advisor, which is the equivalent to a prime minister, in the presence of diplomats, civil society members, and top businessmen at the presidential palace in Dhaka. AP correspondent Karen Shamus reports on recent unrest in Britain following a spate of far-right protest throughout the country.
Britain remains on alert for further unrest as tensions rise following a wave of anti-immigrant protests throughout the country. Police had been expecting a wave of planned far-right protests targeting offices of immigration lawyers and others offering services to migrants. But those demonstrations failed to materialise as police and counter-protesters filled the streets. Carrying signs saying refugees welcome and chanting, "Whose streets are streets?" People turned out in force to protect asylum service centres and the offices of immigration attorneys. Karen Chamas, London.
An Austrian teenager arrested over an alleged plot to strike a Taylor Swift concert in Vienna planned to carry out a suicide attack that would have caused a bloodbath and vowed loyalty to Islamic State, according to the Austrian Chancellor Karl Niehammer on Thursday.
Unmittelbar before.
The suspect was planning a lethal assault among the estimated 20,000 fans set to gather outside Vienna's Ernst Stadium. Austria's National Intelligence had said earlier two other Austrian youths aged 17 and 15 were detained on Wednesday over the reported plot. U.S. broadcaster ABC cited law enforcement and intelligence sources as saying Austrian authorities had received information about the Swift concert threat from U.S. intelligence. The presidential campaign of Venezuelan opposition and candidate Edmundo Gonzalez says he will not appear before the country's high court. The court is holding hearings related to an election audit requested by President Nicolas Maduro. Gonzalez has questioned the legality of the proceedings and expressed serious concerns over his safety. The hearings followed days of global criticism of Maduro and his loyal National Electoral Council over presidential election results. Electoral authorities declared Maduro the winner but have yet to produce voting tallies. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Friday, August 9th, and here are some of the stories we are following. Analysts say African protests for change often fall short of their desired goals.
One thing that is certain is that African young people are angry. They are asking their leaders to do better. They are asking their leaders to change. They are asking their leaders to govern in their interests.
The U.S. criticized the Kenyan government's handling of youth-led anti-government protests. Tunisia, the birth of the Arab Spring, appears to be moving in the opposite direction ahead of presidential elections in October. Indigenous people still face discrimination worldwide on this Indigenous Peoples Day today, Friday. Zimbabwe's leader rules out extending the number of terms a president can serve.
I'm a constitutionalist. I want our party, our leadership, our people to be constitutionalists. We must abide by the provisions of our constitution to the letter.
And a close look at the Republican Party foreign policy during the 2024 election campaign. The story plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Kenyan youth protested again in Nairobi on Thursday, calling for better governance and reforms. Similar movements across Africa, such as in Nigeria, Uganda, and Zimbabwe, have seen some success, but often fall short of their goals. Experts say that young Africans need to rethink their approach to political mobilization. Mohammed Yusuf reports.
Kenyan youth marched again Thursday to demand that President William Ruto vacate office for failing to provide good governance, manage corruption, or improve their lives. Demonstrators scored a rare major success 2 months ago when they forced Ruto to withdraw the Finance Bill 2024, which proposed higher taxes on food and financial transactions. The protests also forced the president to dissolve his cabinet and appoint a new police boss. The success of the Kenyan demonstrators has inspired protests over the past 2 weeks against corruption in Uganda and rallies against the high cost of living in Nigeria. McDonald Lewanika is the head of Accountability Hub, East and Southern Africa, an organization that promotes good governance for Africa. He says young Africans are generally unhappy with their governments and others managing their countries.
One thing that is certain is that African young people are mad. They are angry. They are dissatisfied. And in that dissatisfaction, and they are asking their leaders to do better. They are asking their leaders to change. They are asking their leaders to govern in their interest.
Afrobarometer, a Pan-African research network, surveyed 39 African countries from 2021 to 2023 and found that overwhelmingly Africans see their governments as failing and those leading them are becoming less trustworthy to run the affairs of the state. Some experts say the age gap between the young population and the elderly presidents of many countries is contributing to the anger in the streets. Lewanika says African youth movements need to push on common agendas that do not create division.
I think that what young people's movements need to do is to remain pure and committed to the issues, because the issues see no political color.
Kenyan President Ruto, who continues to face protests while presiding over the swearing-in of the new cabinet, admitted Thursday that there was a disconnect between the public and those in the government.
It is true, and I freely admit, that due to suboptimal communication of our development agenda and a feeling of insufficient public engagement, we have lost many opportunities to walk the journey of transforming Kenya with everyone aboard, leaving some citizens unable to connect with the policies, programs, and projects that have been rolled out throughout our country.
Experts warn that more protests may follow if African leaders do not address the needs of the young citizens. Mohammed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
The United States has condemned Kenya's government's handling of youth-led anti-government protests and is demanding immediate action against human rights violations. Macharia Munene is a professor of history and international relations at the United States International University in Nairobi, Kenya. He tells viewers Douglas Mpuga that the principle of the right to peacefully assemble is being violated.
Well, the government appears to have been very well prepared to stop
the protests. And it seems to have executed that desire very well. But the protesters appear also to be determined to continue. They announced very early what they intended to do. But it has not gone as some people expected or feared, in part because the demonstrators themselves have been infiltrated. Some of them are divided. And it looks as if the government was better prepared for them in terms of stopping than it had been before.
Yeah, except now there are concerns from the U.S. government over the Kenyan government's handling of these protests, and the U.S. is urging for immediate action to address alleged human rights violations. Are you concerned about that aspect?
Yeah, there is a source of concern. It's a point of concern. And yes, the U.S. government, for as I know, has deep concern and reservations about the way the government is handling the whole thing. Because the principle of the right to assemble is being violated because they're not being allowed to assemble. There have been pictures and shows of people being roughed up. Even one of the journalists, I think, had some canisters fired at him, not by accident, but seemingly deliberate, and captured very well in the video.
Yes, some people have died, as you say. And do you think the Ruto government is capable of balancing those two acts, the right to protest and making sure that there's no violence?
Well, there was a time when it looked as if they were balancing and they were doing their best. But now it's becoming doubtful whether they're inclined to balance. They just want to stop from what is appearing. And there have been, of course, some musical chairs at the top of the police structure. Maybe they've got the right players at the top to do what is supposed to be done to stop any movements with regard to the assembly, the protest assemblies. And even the local media have been very muted, it would appear, because the whole day none of the local media were able to show what was going on.
Macharia Munene is a professor of history and international relations at the United States International University in Nairobi, Kenya. He spoke from the Kenyan capital with VOA's Douglas Mpuga. As political and economic protests have consumed Africa in recent months, Tunisia, the birthplace of the Arab Spring, appears to be moving in the opposite direction ahead of presidential elections in October. President Kai Saied fired his prime minister this week, and an opposition candidate was sentenced to 2 years imprisonment for criticizing the lack of transparency in the country's electoral process. Omar Khaled is a Middle East, North Africa, and Turkey intelligence analyst. He tells me that the dismissal of the prime minister is not surprising because President Saied wants to consolidate power ahead of the elections.
I think that Qais Saied has been planning to do so, especially before the elections. Now we've got the elections on the 6th of October. So changing the government, I think, makes sense because Qais Saied basically needs to have a fresh start before he starts his second term. And he will almost certainly win the second term. So I guess, yes, it makes sense. I mean, if we look into Qais Saied's policies, populist stances, he always wants to consolidate most powers under his control, whether it is judicial powers, executive or legislative. So I don't think that dismissing the existing prime minister is a surprise for many analysts who cover Tunisia, because it was quite expected.
This is also coming on the heels of the opposition leader being sent to prison, as you mentioned, ahead of the election. So what does all this mean?
Actually, since Qais Saied started his reign, I think around 2019, Tunisia is now a very, very different place than the one which started what's called the Arabian Spring. Qais Saied actually wanted to implement autocratic policies from day one. So across the last 5 years, he started to basically mitigate any presence of opposition, activities, events. He started jailing right away most of the prominent dissidents, specifically from the Islamist party, which is called Al-Nahda. The Nahda movement is a very prominent opposition movement in Tunisia. And Rashid Al-Ghannouchi, the one that you've been mentioning, who was actually jailed, was from day one. Saeed considered him as an enemy.
We know that there's dissatisfaction also inside Tunisia. How likely do you think we might see another Arab Spring in Tunisia?
Yes, there will be protests, but the protests are highly likely to be small to medium in scale. Also, these protests are highly likely to be confronted by the security forces, because Saeed, I think he will highly likely seek to control the streets, because you know that if there is a large protest against him before the elections, that could pose a substantial threat to his government stability and to his whole regime.
Omar Kadre is a Middle East and North Africa and a Turkey intelligence analyst. He was speaking with us from London, United Kingdom. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty, Washington. Today is Friday, August 9th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And still to come on our program, Something for Mali Sports. Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa says he is not extending his presidency beyond the current 2 5-year terms allowed by the country's constitution. As Columbus Mavunga reports from the Zimbabwe capital Harare, there are some who have expressed skepticism about his stated commitment to the constitution.
Chants by members of the ruling ZANU-PF party echo in the air as those gathered at party headquarters await the arrival of President Emmerson Dambuzo Mnangagwa. They say Mnangagwa will still be in power in 2030, 2 years after what the constitution allows him. The slogans are repeated as Mnangagwa arrives and addresses the crowd.
Besides being a soldier, I'm a trained lawyer. I'm a constitutionalist. I want our party, our leadership, our people to be constitutionalists. We must abide by the provisions of our constitution to the letter. Kanangwe kutuinde inda, no inda.
In his native language, Shona, Mnangagwa adds, when time comes to go home, I will go home. Let's follow the principles of the party, he said, gaining more cheers. After ruling for nearly 40 years, the late Robert Mugabe was removed from power with help from the army and succeeded by Mnangagwa, who became interim president in November 2017. Mnangagwa won a disputed election in 2018. Kudzai Mutisi, a pro-ZANU-PF political commentator, says he believes Mnangagwa will not be like Mugabe.
What is important here is that he's addressing some of the people who have been lobbying him to stay beyond 2028. So whatever people have been saying has nothing really to do with him.
Some Zimbabweans fear Mnangagwa may change the constitution to seek a third term. Brighton Mutemuka is a lawyer opposed to the views of the ruling party. He believes Mnangagwa, also known as ED from the initials of his first and middle names, will change the constitution so that he stands for a third term in 2028.
By coming out publicly to claim otherwise, ED is trying to hoodwink the gullible in his party, the other faction, and also SADC as well. I think he's trying to wrong-foot SADC and preempt any questions that SADC might pose, which would sit uncomfortably for him.
SADC refers to the Southern African Development Community, a 13-nation bloc which looks at how members are abiding by their constitutions. A SADC observer mission, Zimbabwe will take over the 12-month rotating chair of the SADC following a meeting next week. Columbus Mafunga,
Viewer News, Harare.
More than 86% of indigenous people globally work in the informal economy. This is according to the International Labour Organization, which says they earned 18.5% less than non-indigenous people. As the world marks Indigenous Peoples Day today, Friday, the United Nations notes that they are three times more likely to be living in extreme poverty than others. Maureen Ojiambo reports.
The International Day of the World's Indigenous People is observed on 9th August each year with the aim of recognizing and promoting their rights, culture, and contributions globally. The United Nations says most indigenous people are more exposed to infectious diseases, forced assimilation, and cultural disruption. Antonio Guterres is the United Nations Secretary General.
Indigenous peoples represent around 6% of the world's population, yet they're still an outsized contribution to our global community. They are the keepers of knowledge and traditions that help safeguard some of the most biodiverse areas of our planet. As guardians of the environment, their survival is our survival.
Guterres says the majority of the indigenous people's rights are violated.
Indigenous peoples are often the victims of threats and violence. Extractive and productive sectors like mining, agriculture, and transport have accelerated deforestation and land degradation. Ancestral homelands and natural resources that they depend on for survival are coming under siege.
From ancient days, indigenous cultures have relied on forests for food, shelter, and medicines, as well as spiritual and mental health. Alice Nyamihanda is a member of the Batwa indigenous community in Uganda.
Batwa were evicted from their ancestral lands in 1991 by the government of Uganda for creation of national parks. Batwa were left with no compensation. Batwa were scattered and landless.
On the other hand, Leonard Mindore from the indigenous community in Kenya says his community has always faced forced evictions.
The issue of segregation, unfortunately, has been part and parcel of our daily lives. We have been marginalized from all spheres of life, be it in development, jobs, leadership. Despite of all these challenges, Ogiek have held their heads high and continuously fought for these rights.
The UN says the day recognizes the achievements and contributions made by the indigenous people in protecting the environment.
Today and every day, the world must stand behind the rights of indigenous peoples to chart their own futures. Together, let us safeguard their rights to live in peace and dignity.
This year's theme for the International Day for the World's Indigenous People is protecting the rights of indigenous people in voluntary isolation and initial contact. For VOA Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in San Francisco.
Congressional Republicans closely align with presidential nominee Donald Trump on a number of key foreign policy issues, including U.S. support for Israel. But as VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson reports, lawmakers still have significant differences on China, tariff policy, and aid to Ukraine that could complicate a second Trump term.
Former President Donald Trump meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu last month.
No president has done what I've done for Israel, and we've always had a very good relationship.
Trump has previously criticized Netanyahu for security failures he claims enabled the October 7th Hamas attack. Unpredictability was a hallmark of Trump's foreign policy while in office. One analyst told VOA the Republican Party's 2024 foreign policy platform reflects that. Chris Tuttle is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations.
There are not a ton of specifics. That gives him the advantage of being able to shape a policy in a way that he sees fit in the moment rather than getting locked into policies at the outset of a term.
Trump's fellow Republicans claim the social media app TikTok is controlled by the Chinese government and can be used to access user information and influence political beliefs. Republican Senator Mitt Romney.
I do not want the Chinese Communist Party getting personal data about our citizens, nor being able to have algorithms that would propagandize the American public.
But Trump reversed his position on banning TikTok this year.
We're going to save TikTok. They want to destroy TikTok. So all of the people on TikTok vote for Trump.
Trump has also criticized NATO, claiming member countries do not pay their fair share for the common defense. His running mate, vice presidential nominee J.D. Vance, has been even more critical of the United States sending aid money to Ukraine.
But let's not mistake the courage of the Ukrainian troops on the ground with the fact that they have the most corrupt leadership and corrupt government in Europe, and maybe the most corrupt leadership anywhere in the world.
That is in direct opposition to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who has argued aid to Ukraine is essential to defending democracy in Europe.
It's no longer a settled question that America will meet aggression with overwhelming force, or even that we'll back our allies 100%.
Analysts say Trump's calls to raise tariffs if he is elected to a second term could cause the most conflict with Republican lawmakers. Gordon Gray is a former U.S. ambassador and now a professor at the George Washington University.
It shows the transformation of the Republican Party since 2016, because the Republicans historically have been free traders.
Trump has pledged to introduce at least 60% tariffs on China and 10% tariffs on imports from other countries if he is reelected. Catherine Gibson, VOA News.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sport with the latest news from the Paris 2024 Olympic Games. Botswana's Leslie Tebogo became the first African to win the Olympic 200 meters on Thursday as he upstaged Noah Lyles' plans for a sprint double in Paris. The 21-year-old Tebogo was able to ease up at the end and still clocked an African record of 19.46 seconds for gold, with American Kenny Bednarek taking silver in 19.62 seconds and Lyles fading to bronze in 19.70 seconds. Tebogo, sixth in the Paris 100 meters final, lined up with a 200 meters personal best of 19.50, notably down on the favorite's 19.31 seconds.
The first time when I started my training for the Olympics, we perfected the curve each and every day without fail. So I knew if I could get that perfection today and don't stumble from the block, I knew I could match Kenny.
In Olympic football, Morocco secured their first ever Olympic medal in men's football with a resounding 6-0 triumph over Egypt in the bronze medal match at the Paris 2024 Olympic Games on Thursday. The Atlas Lions, led by the talismanic Sofiane Rahimi, produced a scintillating performance that left the Egyptian side utterly outclassed and their supporters stunned into silence at the Stade de la Boujour in Nantes. Rahimi, the tournament's top scorer, added two more goals to his tally, taking his individual haul to a remarkable 8 strikes over the course of the games. In boxing news, Cindy Ngamba won the refugee Olympic team their first ever medal on Thursday when she clinched a bronze medal in women's boxing. Ngamba, who was born in Cameroon, was beaten by Panama's 7th seed Athena Bailon by split decision in the semifinals of the women's 75 kilograms category. That denied her a place in Saturday's final, but boxing hands out bronze medals for losing semi-finalists. In basketball news, thousands of people turned out on Thursday to give a hero's welcome to South Sudan's basketball team after their first ever appearance at the Olympic Games. The performance of the bright stars in Paris has been a source of joy for the world's youngest nation, even though their dreams of medal glory were dashed when they failed to reach the quarterfinals after group stage defeats by the United States and Serbia. Team captain Kwani Kwani told jubilant fans at the stadium in Juba that through basketball, the whole world now knows who South Sudan is.
The best thing for us players was, you know, watching the videos, watching everybody here celebrate, just watching, you know, all our countries come together. You know, it was really a uniting factor. And I think one of the biggest moments where I saw all our South Sudanese unite.
And that's it for this Friday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a nice weekend. And that's it for this Friday, August 9th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing that you will have a great weekend. We'll see you again on Monday morning. Mm-hmm.